you got questions, probably the best thing to do is put in a chat for the people online. And for the people here in 470 at Griffith Hall, I'll probably call on them at the end of the presentation. So we'll start with the introduction for Christian Nader. He's going to talk about observations of chain aggregates in the Florida Cirrus Cloud Anvil on 3 August 2019 during CAPEX. And Christian, unfortunately, wasn't on the field project, but several people that were in attendance. He started working on this project in January of 2020. And so it's been 2.5 years for this work. So we shall be excited to hear what you have to say, Christian. So with that, I'll try to mute myself here and we'll let you take it away.
Sounds good. Well, thanks, Dave. And thanks for everyone tuning in. The title of my thesis is Observations of Chain Aggregates in Florida Cirrus Cloud Anvils on the 3rd of August, 2019, during the CAPE experiment that was performed in 2019. Oops, let's see if I can. So the main objective for my thesis is to hopefully provide insight and possibly answer the question, is chain aggregation occurring in the cirrus cloud anvil region of Florida thunderstorms on the 3rd of August, 2019? And below here is just an example of one of the chain aggregates that was observed during the research flight on this day. This image was taken by the FIPS probe on the Citation II research aircraft. So some motivation for this work. Well, the chain aggregation process is still not well understood currently. We don't exactly know where or how the chain aggregates how the chain aggregation process occurs within the cloud. And there's inconsistencies between the cloud chamber experiments as well as previous airborne observations. And such inconsistencies include, you know, the cloud chamber experiments have different environmental parameters than where the chain aggregates are observed in the real atmosphere. And now, you know, cirrus clouds are very important. You know, they can cover over a wide range of the globe at any given time. And they have global and regional climatological impacts. And to accurately measure their impacts on the climate, we must first figure out and analyze particle types found in these clouds. This is because it is known that cirrus clouds radiative impacts are based on many different parameters, such as the cloud particle sizes, as well as their asymmetry factor. Furthermore, chain aggregates may alter supersonic projectile trajectories by possibly creating microscopic dents on the nose cones that are attached to the very front of the supersonic vehicle. And this is because that the relatively large chain aggregates may bypass the bow shock, which is outlined here in red, without disintegrating or evaporating and causing these dents, which alters the aerodynamics of the vehicle and then possibly altering the projectile's trajectory. Now, going into some of the previous work, some previous cloud chamber experiments have been performed testing and investigating the chain aggregation process. And chain aggregates were generated in using high electric fields with a minimum threshold of 60 kilovolts per meter, you know, range of temperatures between -5 and -37 degrees Celsius, and using ice crystal concentrations on the order of 10 to the 6 cubic meters, and using ice crystal sizes between 30 and 50 microns. And some examples are shown in this plot to the right, adapted by Saunders and Wahab in 1975, where they were able to generate these chain-like aggregates in the cloud chambers. And it was shown that aggregation increases at approximately 30% in electric fields on the order of magnitude higher than the minimum threshold at temperatures at -8 degrees Celsius. And this is where the maximum effect of the aggregation occurred, where if you go colder in temperature, that aggregation percentage decreases exponentially. So it was found that aggregation is temperature dependent with the electric fields. Now, going into some of the previous aircraft observations, within continental convection with some maritime influence, mainly in the tropics and subtropics, chain aggregates of pristine ice crystals were observed. And you can, as you can see in the top right panel, where some chain aggregates were observed in tropical convection cirrus anvils from the Emerald II experiment. Furthermore, continental convection in the mid latitudes is shown to has a frozen droplets of chain aggregates have been observed in their cirrus anvils, as shown in the bottom right hand figure. Moreover, there are a few chain aggregates observed near updraft regions of Florida thunderstorms at around -8 degrees Celsius, with some of the chain aggregates containing some rime ice present. Now, going into a more later field campaign, the CAPE experiment 2015, which was performed in Cape Canaveral, Florida from the 28th of July to the 11th of August in 2015, using the North Dakota Citation II research aircraft, sampled convection-induced cirrus anvils, and chain-like aggregates were observed using the 2DS probe. Now, looking at the right-hand figure here, this is these are images from the 2DS probe, where it's a five-panel diagram, which each panel represents less than 1 second in time, and each panel's vertical width is 1,280 microns. And the observed chain aggregates are circled here in red, and they appear to have some plate-like elements within the chain aggregate. And these were found at 11 kilometers and at temperatures at around minus 43 degrees Celsius. Now, because of the poor resolution and image quality of the 2DS, it's very difficult to discern the exact habits of the observed chain aggregates during this field campaign, which this experiment actually provided motivation to investigate the presence of chain aggregates even further. So succeeding that experiment, the CAPE experiment 2019, which happened in the relative same location and at the same time of the year, utilized the Citation II research aircraft and sampled convection-induced cirrus anvils. They used concurrent measurements between the in-situ platforms as well as the remote sense platforms. And the main goals for this airborne campaign was to investigate the presence of chain aggregates and the chain aggregation process, as well as improve radar interpretation and improve cirrus cloud modeling. Now, going into some of the instrumentation that is more relevant to my work and my thesis work is the first, we have the Nazarov probe, which measures the total water content within the cloud region where the aircraft is sampling. And further to the right here, attached to the port side wing of the aircraft, we have a suite of instruments where the first is the CAPS probe, which is the cloud aerosol and precipitation spectrometer, which contains the SIP probe and the CAS probe, as well as a hot water liquid water content sensor. Now, to the right of that, we have the pitot tube, which is not as relevant to my work, but because it's in the same suite of instruments, it's included in this diagram here. Next to it, we have a temperature probe. And then we also have the FIPS probe, which is the particle habit imaging and polar scattering probe, which takes high definitions of the particles that are sampled, as well as the rotating vane electric field mills. Now, there was a total of 6 electric field mills on the aircraft. They were all positioned on the fuselage ports around the perimeter of the aircraft. Now, the FIPS probe is one of the more important probes relevant to this work. It is a revolutionary probe, and it provides clarity into the link between the microphysical characteristics of the individual ice particles, as well as their respective angular light scattering function. So this is like a hybrid of between two instruments, the first being the polar nephelometer, which would measure the light scattering functions of the crystals, as well as the imaging section of the probe, similar to the cloud particle imaging probe, the CPI. But what's different with this probe is that it provides high definition stereographic images of the same particle, which is very important for my research. So it contains 2 viewing angles separated by an angular distance of 120 degrees. So during the classification process, when classifying the individual particles, having 2 viewing angles is very beneficial because you may see something in one camera versus the other, which is the case on many of the chain aggregates observed. The FIPS also has an optical range of optical magnifications from low to high, 1.4 times, and high being nine times, with a resolution range from 7.2 to 2.35 microns respectively. Now, moving on to the cloud imaging probe, the SIP probe, it's one of the instruments associated with the CAPS probe. and it provides shadow images of the particles being sampled. It contains a particle size range of 12.5 microns, so 100 or 1.55 millimeters with a resolution of 25 microns, and a sample area of 10 centimeters by 100 or 1.55 millimeters. And it's important to note that this probe has a much faster sampling rate than the FIPS. So this probe is much better at obtaining particle concentration data as compared to the FIPS. Now, the post-processing of the data observed with this probe is done using the SOTA2 software package, which takes the respective particle sizes and puts them in their respective particle size bins. Now, moving on to the rotating vane electric field mills. Like I said before, there's a total of 6 electric field mills on the aircraft provided by the University of Alabama in Huntsville. While in operation, the open gaps of the rotating shield electrode, as shown here where my laser pointer is, periodically exposes the sensing plates below to the electric field outside of the aircraft. The electric field values are then calculated as a result of the time-varying charge induced on the sensing plates by the ambient electric field. Now, because the amount of electric field mills we have on the aircraft and the positioning of the electric field mills on the aircraft, we develop a reference coordinate system where it's E of X, E sub Y, and E sub Z, where E sub X is along the X-axis of the aircraft, the roll axis, where E sub X is positive in the direction of flight. Now, E sub Y is being along the wings of the aircraft, the pitch axis, is where, and E sub Y is positive out the left wing, the port side of the aircraft. Now, perpendicular to both those on the Z axis, it is positive, where at level flight, it's positive pointing up above the aircraft. Now, some of the remote sense platforms and data sets used in my thesis, we used the Melbourne National Weather Service Next Generation Radar, which is an S-band radar, as well as the Cloud and Precipitation Radar with Discrete Hydrometeor Detection, otherwise known as the CPR-HD, as shown here in the figure to the right. Now, the CPR-HD is a C-band dual-pole Doppler radar with real-time aircraft tracking capabilities, which is very beneficial for this work. Also, we have the National Lightning Detection Network, NLDN, which consists of around 100 different time of arrival sensors scattered across the United States, which can give locations of where lightning strikes occur, as well as the Kennedy Space Center's Lightning Mapping Array, which is a more localized lightning detection network. And this system detects the various segments of the lightning channel as it develops, revealing the evolution of the lightning structure during discharge. So in general, the Lightning Mapping Array provides additional information into storm morphology and the electrical structure of the thunderstorms. Now, some of the methods for my thesis. So this is a case study for the 3rd of August, 2019 flight day. So first, classify the chain aggregates. The next, analyze the distribution of chain aggregates in the cirrus anvil using a distance from core method, which I will describe in later slides. Next, we calculate the chain aggregate concentrations from the FIPS data and then move it over to the SIP data. We calculate a relative chain aggregate concentrations, as well as non-chain aggregate concentrations. Next, look at the electric fields, perform an analysis on the electric fields to test and see if the observed electric fields within the cirrus anvil during our flight day, in fact, reaches the experimented threshold for which chain aggregation can occur from the cloud chamber experiments. Then we're gonna put all the in-situ microphysical and electrical observations into context by using the remote sense data sets, and more specifically, the CPR-HD. So when classifying the particles, previous experiments, you know, the definition of a chain aggregate was Boolean. It was either yes or no. But while classifying the particles, it was realized that these are very complex particles, and having a range of confidence would actually benefit this study. So this new definition is non-Boolean in nature. It actually ranges in confidence. So the chain aggregates are defined by 3 or more discernible particles oriented in a quasi-linear fashion, particles joined together by small joints, and lengths of particles that are unusually elongated or relatively large. And the confidence is determined by the classifier, which in the case for my thesis was me. And low confidence, a level of one, is one of the three definitions observed. As you can see in the right-hand panel, these chain aggregates have a confidence of one. Moderate confidence is two of the three definitions observed, which is in this middle panel. And high confidence, a level of three, is where all three definitions of a chain aggregate are observed, shown in the right-hand panel. So you can see the level of complexity increases when you go from confidence of one up to confidence of three. Now, back when I said the distance from core method, so we use a list, the LROS Titan, which stands for the LiDAR Radar Open Software Environment Software Package, Thunderstorm Identification, Tracking, and Nowcasting. And we utilize a 335 dBZ threshold to identify and track the individual storms. So on the figure to the right, it's just a plan view of a composite reflectivity image from the Melbourne radar. And you can see first is the aircraft track, colored in white with the arrows, the direction of flight. And where the red circle is, that corresponds to where the aircraft was at the listed timestamp above. But back to the LROS tracking, you could see if you squint hard enough, you'll be able to see thin blue lines that outline the convection. And this is using the 35 dBZ threshold. Now the bolded light blue outline signifies the main convection of interest that is relevant to this study. And because we define a 35 dBZ threshold to identify and track the thunderstorms, we can actually output a latitude and longitude coordinate of the reflectivity centroid that corresponds with that storm core. Thus, for each volume scan, we can actually see how far the aircraft was from the storm core reflectivity centroid. So we can see, and we can use this and compare this to the in-situ microphysical data gathered by the North Dakota Citation II research aircraft. Now let's dive into some of the storm evolution. So the storm, there were storms initially formed on the western coast of Florida, where it developed in a quasi-linear convective system as it moved across the state. Now at around 1330 UTC, the storms began to deteriorate and leaving behind the anvil produced from those storms. However, at around 1500 UTC, the cell was re-enhanced by a surface boundary, which then it became more electrically active. And at 1531, you can see the apparent overshooting top associated with that enhanced convection. Now, this is going back to the previous slide where we have that light blue outline around the convection. This is the storm of interest. This is the otherwise known as the Titan cell. So if you hear me refer back to the Titan cell, this is what I'm referring to, not the other convection near the coast, because that's not really important to our study here. And it's important to note that the aircraft sampling begun at 1551, 15 UTC, and ends at 1626 UTC. So as the storm progresses, it begins to actually merge with the other cells as shown in the previous slide. But by that time, our aircraft has ended its sampling period and it has returned, is on its way returning back to the airport. And then about an hour later, the storms then move offshore into the Atlantic, where they then dissipate by around 1730 UTC. So in total, there were about four flight legs associated with this flight day. So I know this is a very complex diagram, so I'll start in the middle and then work my way out. So in the middle plot, it's just showing a plan view of the Cape Canaveral area. And in the color axis, the color bar here represents time, and that corresponds to the individual flight legs as well as the NLDN cloud to ground lightning strokes. So you can see at around the time when that convection was being enhanced, you get an enhancement in electrical activity with that convection. And you can clearly see that we have two southbound legs and two northbound legs as shown in the corner plots. So flight leg one and three were southbound and flight leg two and four are northbound legs. Flight leg one occurred from 1551 to 1601 UTC. Flight leg two occurred from 1602 to 1607 UTC. Flight leg three occurred from 1609 to 1617 UTC. And flight leg four occurred from 1621-30 to 1627 UTC. Now, it's important to note, looking at the Melbourne composite radar, that our storm is slowly moving to the east as time progresses, where eventually at around 1628, you can see that the now Titan algorithm is now incorporating the other cells because they're merging together. Now going into some of the in-situ microphysical data, now the middle plot is the exact same thing. I actually forgot to mention the black dotted lines, the dotted arrows are the estimated 200 millibar wind direction according to the sounding launched at the field site at 1500 UTC. And the field site is located in the black circle here. This is also where the CPR HD was located. Now going to the corner plots, for each flight leg, the total water content shown on the y-axis and on the x-axis is distance from core. And below that is the arrow indicating the direction of flight. So for each flight leg, the total water content increases closest to the core, except for flight leg one, where we believe that this drop in the total water content is because the aircraft was sampling in a slightly more diffuse cloud region within the cirrus anvil heading towards the storm core. So it's also important to note that for flight leg one and two, the Nazarov, King, and Rice probes indicated no liquid water content is present. Therefore, the total water content measurement is solely of ice. Now, vice versa, for flight leg three and flight leg four, there were small amounts of liquid water, less than 0.1 grams per cubic meter, where at flight leg three, small amounts of liquid water were found at around this area between 30 and 35 kilometers from the Titan cell's reflectivity centroid. And for flight leg four, around 50 to 55 kilometers from the Titan cell's storm core. Now moving on to looking at the SIP total number concentrations, which is in number per cubic centimeter versus distance from core, as well as the, you can see the direction of flight as well. And note, we now have a black line that overlays on top of the individual data points. And this is a centered 20-point moving average, just so you can see the data a little bit more clearly. So the main takeaway for this slide is that the highest total number concentrations are always when the aircraft is closest to the core, where they then decrease as the aircraft heads further away or is coming from further away from the core. And this makes relative sense because, a majority of the particles being generated are formed within the main convective region. So it's safe to assume that you would see more higher concentrations of ice closest to the storm core. Now moving on to some of the more, this slide is, it gets me every time, just the complexity of the observed chain aggregates, which was imaged by the FIPS. So on the plot to the right here, we have some of the confidence three chain aggregates observed for each of the flight legs. And this is versus distance for the core. So we have far from the core on the left-hand side and close to the core on the right. So the chains show complex structures and orientations. They're quasi-linear and you can tell that they're much different than what a compact ice aggregate is. And they mostly consist of hexagonal plates, sector plates, columns, as well as cap columns. So a wide range of different habits from different temperatures. And approximately 10%, 66 chains out of the total number, if you look down here in this on this table, there were 668 total chains observed out of 4,654 number of images. So that was roughly 14.4% out of were chain aggregates out of all the images taken on the flight legs during the flight legs by the FIPS. And only roughly 10% contained some evidence of riming. As well, there were some signs of sublimation of the chains far from the storm core, roughly 40 to 100 kilometers. As you can see, you could see some rounding of the edges of the plates in some of the chain aggregates imaged here. So in general, when looking at the individual flight legs, flight leg one and three had the most images, and that's mainly because they were just longer flight legs. But mainly for all of the flight legs, most of the chain aggregates were of confidence two, a roughly 6.1% out of the total, out of all the other confidence ranges and the total number of images here. Now looking at the FIPS chain aggregates versus distance from the core, we see that the highest concentrations are between 70 and 100 kilometers from the Titan cell's core, roughly 16.2%, where the smallest concentrations are between 10 to 4 kilometers from the Titan cell's reflectivity centroid, which was at 10%. So in the highest number of chain aggregates observed were between 40 and 70 kilometers from the Titan cell core. So this corresponds to this figure to the right here, where on the y-axis, we have the percentage of chain aggregates. On the bottom x-axis, we have distance from core. And on the top x-axis, we have the total number of images. So immediately you can point out that in the 40 to 70 kilometer range, you have much more FIPS images than from the 10 to 40 kilometer range from the core, as well as the 70 to 100 kilometer range from the core. And this is because there's no data from flight leg four within the 10 to 40 kilometer range. The aircraft was never this close to the reflectivity centroid of the Titan cell. Moreover, there is no data from flight leg two in the 70 to 100 kilometer range. So that's why there's less images on during those two distance intervals. Now you can clearly see, looking at the black square, this is the total average between all the flight legs with respect to distance, or whatever flight legs had data for that distance range. You can see the increase in the percentage of chain aggregates as you head further from the storm core. And you see more agreement from the 10 to 40 kilometer range and less agreement as you head out. Now looking at the all-in chain aggregate sizes. And so what I mean by all-in, the FIPS, when it images the particles, it also attributes a, you know, microphysical, you know, sizing attributes to those imaged particles. However, the imaged particles have to be completely within the field of view of the FIPS to obtain a sizing measurement, in this case, a maximum diameter. So if you look at the box and whisker plot to the right, you can see for flight leg one, and this is just to mention, just the moderate to high level chain aggregates, confident chain aggregates. But you can still, regardless, see how much less chain aggregates were all in. And this is just because they were cut off from the field of view of the FIPS. So that's why there's slightly less numbers of chains within the box and whisker plot down here to the right here. So the sizes, the max diameter range were from approximately 150 to 800 microns. Now the average 25th percentile was 293 microns. The average 50th percentile was 367 microns. And the average 75th percentile was 458 microns. Now these numbers are important for the later slides when we start talking about the SIP data. But all in all, the size distribution of the chain aggregates is similar between all the flight legs. So this indicates that the storm and evolution does not necessarily impact the chain aggregate sizes. So next, bouncing back to the percentiles here, it was found that 83% of the particles were greater than 495 microns imaged by the FIPS. And this is, and the chains that were within this or above this size range had an average confidence between moderate to high. And so you might be asking, why 495 microns? So if you remember, the 75th percentile was very close to that number. And one of the end bins on the SIP after post-processing was 495 microns. So we thought that was a necessary number to look into. Conversely, it was found that 9.5% of particles between 105 and 315 microns imaged by the FIPS are chain aggregates. Now, this is not shown in the table, but these chains had an average confidence between low and moderate. And again, you might be asking why between 105 and 315. So if you remember the 25th percentile, the average 25th percentile was just below 315. So if we want to go lower than that, we looked at the SIP post-processing data and saw that the bins lined up with below this 25th percentile range. And also you might be asking, why'd you stop at 105 microns? Well, this is because the SIP has a shattering problem. So we kind of discount the particles less than 105 microns because of the higher probability of shattered particles being sampled within that size range. So from this, we can make some simplifications if we move from the FIPS data to the SIP concentrations. So some of the simplifications I do here is the particles that greater than 495 microns measured by the SIP are now considered the chain aggregate concentration. And the particles between 105 and 315 microns is now the non-chain aggregate concentration. So this is important to know further down the line in the next few slides. And the particles between 315 and 495 microns is the buffer zone between the two concentrations. So you don't have the overlap between the concentrations. So now going into the concentration data using the SIP data, if you look at the figures to the right, each plot, it shows flight leg 1, 2, 3, and 4. On the y-axis, it's concentration and the units are number per cubic centimeter versus distance from the storm core, as well as the direction of flight. And you can see that on all four plots. Now, immediately you see that there are more non-chain aggregates than chain aggregates. And this makes sense. You're gonna see more smaller particles than you are larger particles just by the population of the smaller particles in the cirrus anvil. The highest chain aggregate concentrations were nearest to the core, except for flight leg 1. If you look at the black line here, the black line is the chain aggregate concentration, the green line is the non-chain aggregate concentration, and the red is the total number concentration. So you can see in the black line here, for flight leg 2, 3, and 4, you have the highest concentrations when the aircraft is in relative close proximity to the Titan cell's reflectivity centroid. But for flight leg 1, you have this maximum at around 50 kilometers from the storm core. What's important to note here, however, is that if you look at the non-chain aggregate concentration and the chain aggregate concentration, you see points where the two concentrations converge. For example, at around 55, 56 kilometers from the storm core, you see that these two concentrations actually almost touch each other, where then they diverge heading away from the core. And this is similar for all the other flight legs. Flight leg 2, you have a convergence point at around 57 kilometers from the core. Flight leg 3 actually has two, one at around 50 and one at approximately 61 kilometers from the storm core. And then for flight leg 4, we see a convergent point at around 70, 71 kilometers from the storm core. And it's important to note that the points of convergence are never nearest the closest point to the storm core. It's actually rather tens of kilometers away from the core. Now we develop a parameter, otherwise known as the relative chain aggregate concentration with respect to non-chains, which is essentially highlights these areas of convergence and divergence between the two concentrations. So it's a ratio between the chain aggregate concentration and the non-chain aggregate concentration. So where the concentrations meet, you would see a ratio of 1 in the relative chain aggregate concentration with respect to non-chains, otherwise known as the RCACNC, which is what I will be showing right now. So like before, we have the same center plot, which just shows the NLDN data, the 200 millibar wind direction, as well as the individual flight legs. And now in the corner plots is displayed the RCACNC, so which is the relative chain aggregate concentration with respect to non-chains. So if I bounce back to the previous slide here, you can see the convergence point for flight leg 1 at around 51 kilometers from the storm core. Now going back here, you can see that this is where the peak in the RCACNC is, because you have a similar agreement between the two concentrations. You almost have a ratio of 1-to-1, meaning you have the same amount of chain aggregates as non-chain aggregates at that given distance. Now the black dotted line for each plot indicates the 0.5 level. So below the 0.5 RCACNC, this indicates where the chains and non-chain aggregates concentrations are not similar. In this case, higher concentrations of non-chain aggregates relative to chain aggregates. And conversely, what I said before, if it's above 0.5, you have more agreement between those two concentrations. So the main takeaway for all the flight legs, RCAC NC is lower while closest to the Titan cell's core and increases up to a certain distance, tens of kilometers from the Titan cell's reflectivity centroid before dropping off quickly. And you can see that for all four different flight legs where you have this increase up to the certain distance. Now this plays an important role when looking at some of the remote sensed platforms. Now let's look at some of the electric field observations and see if this peak in RCAC away from the core has any relation to the electric field observations. If the electric field is greater than 60 kilovolts per meter, this may indicate that the chain aggregation process might be occurring within the Cirrus Anvil region itself. So on the diagram to the right, we have the electric field data. So it's flight leg 1, 2, 3, and 4. On the y-axis on all the plots, we have the vertical electric field, E sub z measured in kilovolts per meter, indicated in the blue solid line. Now on the right-hand axis, we have the electric field magnitude, which takes into account the E sub x, y, and z. And it's also measured in kilovolts per meter. And on the x-axis for all the plots, it's going forward in time from left to right. Does not have any relation to the direction of flight as in previous plots. So for all flight legs, the electric field magnitude is on the order of 10 to the 1 kilovolts per meter. And I believe, yeah, the maximum in the electric field magnitude occurred during flight leg 1, where it was around 22.5 kilovolts per meter. And it's also noteworthy that the strongest in electric field is in relative close proximity to the Titan cell's reflectivity centroid. As you can see for flight leg 1 and 2, these were both southbound legs. So going forward in time, we were heading towards the storm core. And then conversely for flight leg 3 and 4, we were nearest to the storm core when the flight leg started. So you see the highest electric field magnitudes when the aircraft was in close proximity to the storm core. Now, flight leg 1, the vertical electric field peaked in strength at negative 22.37 kilovolts per meter. And we believe that this peak is actually caused by the aircraft being in such close proximity to the core and near the and just below the overshooting top that the upper positive charge region, which was situated around 11 to 11 and a half kilometers, according to the lightning mapping array data, influenced the vertical electric field, having it point downwards. So it reached a maximum of negative 22.37 kilovolts per meter. And like I said, prior, the electric field magnitude was on the order of 10 to 1, which is similar to the threshold. It's on the same order of magnitude as the electric field threshold tested in the cloud chamber experiments. However, it never reached 60 kilovolts per meter, that magic number tested in the cloud chamber experiments. Now let's move on to some of the radar and satellite data. On the left-hand plot, we have the GO-16 visible satellite data on a plan view. Also overlaid is the aircraft flight track for flight leg 1. And in color is the relative chain aggregate concentration with respect to non-chains. So if you remember before where there was a peak in the RCACNC at a certain distance from the core is indicated in the yellow, and the dark and the blue purplish colors are the relatively low RCACNC. So in the red box here is the scanning area of the CPRHD, where it started sampling the aircraft and followed the aircraft and tracked it in real time. It started from to the northern part of the box and follow the aircraft going down to the bottom edge of the box. So if you go over to the right-hand panel, we have the CPRHD data for this, this time frame during flight leg 1. On the y-axis, we have altitude above ground level in kilometers, and on the x-axis, we have time, and as well as the direction of flight from north to south here. Now, going back to the left-hand plot, it's clear that for about half the flight leg, it's sampling a more diffuse region of the Cirrus anvil. Now, if you remember, even prior, at around 1530 UTC is when the overshooting top from the enhanced convection of the Titan cell became apparent. And so the more diffuse region of the Cirrus anvil is actually the Cirrus anvil from older convection. So this is now referred to as the old Cirrus anvil. We're at about halfway where we start to see the different colors show up in the RCACNC is where the newly developed Cirrus anvil from our Titan cell is becoming apparent, and it's actually showing in the data. And you can actually see this on the right-hand plot where the aircraft is sampling at around 10 kilometers as shown in the aircraft flight track contamination, that it's sampling in a more diffuse region before transferring through a boundary between the old and the new Cirrus anvil. And it's interesting too, is that when we start to traverse through the boundary between the old and the new Cirrus anvil, we start to see the increase in the RCACNC, which I'll show on the next plot here. So on the next, the left-hand plot is the exact same plot as before, but on the right-hand plot, we have a more compressed version of the CPRHD. It just spans from 9 to 11 kilometers in the vertical instead of the previous plot, which is around, you know, 7 kilometers to 13 kilometers. And again, it's the same x-axis for all the plots, and as well as the direction of flight. Now, in the middle plot here, we have the concentrations in number per cubic centimeter of the non-chain aggregate concentration, as well as the chain aggregate concentration. And you can see, as shown before, where you have the convergence of the two concentrations, roughly around 55 kilometers from the storm core, is where you have this peak in the relative chain aggregate concentration, which is shown here in red. Also shown here in blue, and the blue dash is the relative chain aggregate concentration with respect to all particles. And it kind of follows the same same trajectory as the RCACNC. And I forgot to mention, if I go back one slide here, for flight leg one, we actually sampled just below the overshooting top, which is also shown at the very top of the radar image. Now, this is important when we start to discuss where these chain aggregates are coming from. And since we see this incline in the relative chain aggregate concentration at the boundary between the Cirrus from the old convection and the Cirrus anvil from the newer convection, and then where it quickly drops off, we believe that quite possibly that these chain aggregates are being formed somewhere within the convective region of the thunderstorm, and more likely in the overshooting top, where they then precipitate down in this quote unquote corridor of high concentrations of chain aggregates. And then the aircraft samples through that quote unquote corridor, where that is possibly the reason why the concentrations are relatively similar in this part of the Cirrus anvil. Now moving on and looking at flight leg four. Now you might be asking, why not flight leg two and three? And this is because we want to look at the storm when it's during the research flight, when it was the earliest, versus when during the last portion of the flight leg, which the Cirrus was the oldest. So for flight leg four, well, let me just back up real quick. This is the same sort of diagrams as shown before for flight leg one, but just for flight leg four. So on the left, it's a plan view image of the GO-16 visible satellite for between 1621 and 1624 UTC. And this was a northbound leg as compared to flight leg one was a southbound leg. So now as time progresses, if you look at the just the overall satellite imagery, a half hour, 25 minutes has progressed for the Cirrus anvil associated with the Titan cell to expand further out and to evolve and develop. And so flight leg four actually samples more of that of the Titan cells induced Cirrus anvil than flight leg one, where flight leg one sampled half of flight leg one sampled older Cirrus anvil regions. Now it's important to note here, if you look at the RCAC NC with in relation to flight leg four, at the very edge of the scanning period is where we have this peak and the relative chain aggregate concentration with respect to non-chains. So you have similar concentrations of the two concentrations, the non-chains and the chains. Now moving over to the right, first I want to mention the fact that the Cirrus Anvil sampled during flight leg four is very complex and is not uniform. And also to note is that there might be some sorts of some wave-like features at the very top of this anvil region. But going back to the RCACNC, we see this peak at the very end of the flight leg where it's not where the highest regions of the highest reflectivity regions are within the new Cirrus Anvil region. And I also want to mention that the CPRHD was scanning from the south to the north following the aircraft. And you can see that in the flight leg aircraft track contamination shown in the right-hand plot here. So again, similar to flight leg one, it's a more compressed version of the CPRHD on the right-hand plot, on the right-hand top plot, where it's just from 9 to 11 kilometers above ground level. Middle plot showing the concentrations of non-chains shown in purple and the chain aggregate concentration shown in green. And the bottom plot showing the relative chain aggregate concentration with respect to non-chains, as well as with respect to all particles measured by the SIP. So again, just to note that we see the highest in the RCACNC at the more diffuse region on the outskirts of the newly developed Cirrus Anvil region, which is associated with the Titan cell. And you can clearly see in the red line here is the slope, the positive slope in the relative chain aggregate concentration with respect to non-chains. Meaning that as we head out further into the Cirrus Anvil, you're having similar concentrations of non-chains as chains, and it's actually increasing. All the while, if you look at the middle plot here, the overall concentrations between the chain aggregate and the non-chain aggregate concentrations are decreasing as you head further away from the core. So we think this might be the case, one or two things, or possibly both, might be going on here is the reason why the RCACNC is increasing and has a positive slope heading away from the core. And we believe that either the smaller particles are sublimating away before the larger particles have time to sublimate away, which would give reason why those concentrations are kind of converging towards the end of the Cirrus Anvil. And or the smaller particles are in fact aggregating into chain aggregates, aggregating into larger particles. And we see these chain aggregates far away from the storm core, from the FIPS data. So they're not aggregating into larger aggregates, according to the FIPS. They're aggregating into chain aggregates. So in conclusion, it's shown that chain aggregates show similar complexity to the previous airborne and cloud chamber experiments. You know, they contain particles of different habits, and they're elongated, and oriented in a quasi-linear fashion. In fact, 14.4% of the FIPS images classified were chain aggregates. Now going into some of the flight leg data, flight leg one provides evidence that chain aggregation is occurring within the main convective region of the storm. We have the highest relative chain aggregate concentrations with respect to non-chains nearest to the storm core at the boundary between the old and the new Cirrus Anvil. And the particle elements found in the chain aggregates, according to the FIPS, are from different temperature regimes from around -5 to -40 degrees Celsius. We see plates, we see columns, and we see capped columns. And these are formed in a wide range of temperatures, but they're aggregated together. We also see a lack of rime chains at the end of flight leg one, suggesting that this chain aggregation process might be occurring above the homogeneous freezing level, which is around -35 degrees Celsius, give or take a few degrees, depending on the environment. And we think a more fit region for where this chain aggregation process is occurring is, again, above the homogeneous freezing level, and possibly in the region where the upper positive charge region is situated. which is around 11 to 12 kilometers above ground level, which is similar to the location and to the height of where the overshooting top is. And if you remember back in the satellite imagery, the overshooting top was relatively convective. So you have a mixture of particles, you know, constantly bumping into each other, and you have the influence of the electric fields. And because the electric field, because the evidence of lightning, we can infer that the electric fields were high enough for this chain aggregation process to occur within the main convective region of the Titan cell. Furthermore, flight legs 2 and 4 provide evidence that chain aggregation is actually continuing in the Cirrus Anvil. We have this positive slope in the RCA CNC heading away from the storm core as the overall concentrations decrease. This might be the case, or the other case that I've shown, that either these smaller particles are sublimating away before the chain aggregates sublimate away. But it could be the mixture of both these things, because we do still observe smaller particles far away from the anvil, and we also observe chain aggregates farther away from the anvil on all of these flight legs. However, an argument that goes against this is the fact that the electric field strengths never surpass the laboratory tested threshold for chain aggregation occur, which, if you remember, was 60 kilovolts per meter. And the strongest electric fields that we observed were nearest the core, maximum being 22.5 kilovolts per meter, where for the rest of the Cirrus Anvil heading away from the core, majority of the electric field values within the Cirrus Anvil were a magnitude lower, between, you know, 1 and 9 kilovolts per meter. So this actually argues against that. However, this is an area of future work, which I will discuss next. So we want to perform further analysis on other research flights during the CAPEX 19 field campaign. Just to remind you, this is just an analysis on one of the flight days. So we have a total of, I believe, 7 or 8 other flights to look at and to see and to compare and contrast and see if there's any similarities or differences in regarding the chain aggregates observed and the electric fields observed. We also think it would be beneficial to do more future campaigns and possibly adjust the sampling methods, possibly using more than one aircraft and doing different aircraft trajectories, possibly doing spirals through the main convective region and also sampling the overshooting top, as well as the Cirrus Anvil region. Also, I think it'd be beneficial to sample cirrus cloud anvils in other geographical regions and also at different parts of the year. And so since we know that, you know, for example, lake effect snow and nor'easter systems can be relatively convective, it'd be interesting to see if chain aggregates are also observed within those systems. It is also the plan to perform more cloud chamber experiments to test to see if chain aggregation can occur using electric fields less than 60 kilovolts per meter at temperatures less than minus 30 degrees Celsius. Now, this would provide further confidence that, yes, that possibly the chain aggregation process can occur in the Cirrus Anvil region at colder temperatures than previously tested. So now I have some acknowledgments. I'd like to talk about a few people. I'd love to thank my thesis committee. They've really helped me over the past few years and helped develop this work and also share their ideas and collaborate. And I greatly appreciate every single one of them. As well, I'd like to thank Jerry Schmidt, who's a part of the Naval Research Laboratory, for taking me in as an intern last summer and doing some more analysis and also going more hands-on with his newly developed field site in Monterey, California. I'd also like to thank Joshua Hoover, who works at the Naval Surface Warfare Center, who actually has the tough duty of getting all of us together, people from UND and several folks from the NRL, and to collaborate and talk about results and talk about the science and share ideas. So I greatly appreciate him for organizing that, as well as the many other things that he does campaign-wise. I'd also like to thank Andy Detweiler for always showing up to the committee meetings every single week and providing his expertise in this field of science. I'd also like to thank Hugh Christian from the University of Alabama Huntsville for talking about and elaborating on the electric fields and providing insight about the electrical structure of the storm sampled during this flight day. I'd also like to thank Jeff Stith, who's part of NCAR, for zooming in and talking to Dave, Andy, and I, and sharing his expertise in this chain aggregation process, as well as all the microphysical knowledge that he has. I'd also like to thank Ron Holly from Visala for allowing me to get the National Lightning Detection Network data nice and smoothly. I'd also like to thank Nick Gapp for, and I'd also like to apologize to Nick Gapp for constantly bugging him and asking him questions about the CPR-HD radar, as well as Jerry for constantly bugging him, trying to get the data from him, and just sharing your expertise and filling me in on some of the gaps that I might be missing. So I want to thank you for that. I'd also like to thank Jake Mulholland, who without him, I probably would not be in graduate school as of right now. We went storm chasing a few summers ago while I was an undergrad, and he really pushed me and persuaded me to take the GRE and to send my resume out to some graduate schools. And I'm thankful for UND for giving me the chance to continue my academic career. I'd also like to thank my friends over back home here in Rochester, New York, and also up in Grand Forks for constantly helping me out and having good times with me and sharing the knowledge for different classes and collaborating. Thank you guys very much, and can't wait to see you guys in about a month or so. And last but not least, I'd love to thank my family. Without them, none of this would be possible. And love you guys very much. And yeah, I would not be where I am without you guys supporting me and backing me up and constantly bugging me every single night after work, even when I don't want to talk. So again, thank you very much. And with that, I'll leave my references and leave this slide up with the FIPS image and the citation, and take any questions that you guys have. So thank you guys very much.
Thank you, because I unmuted us here at Crippert Hall, so maybe we take questions from people sitting here first, and the other people can put questions in the chat. And if you want to give a thumbs up for applauding and thanking Nick for his, Christian for his presentation, that'd be good. But any questions here in the audience?
I have a question. Sorry if you showed a slide for it. Great presentation. Were chain aggregates common in some supersaturation regions more than others, or was that not a factor that was a concern here?
That wasn't really a factor of concern. I really did not, key into that much for this research, but definitely something to look at further down the line for sure.
I guess another question too. I'm not sure if your probes can make it out this high of resolution, but were there any variations in like bonding size regions, like between the crystals themselves?
I guess. Actually, excellent question. So if you remember, one of the definitions was, joined by small joints. Yeah. And we usually saw those joints at the corners of the plates, which also signifies, an electrical influence, because you have the strongest electrical potential at the farthest point away from the center of a crystal. Mm-hmm. But there's also other times where it's at the face. So it's kind of random, but that was actually a main thing I tried to look at back when I was, in the beginning of the research, to find evidence that this was in fact actually electrically induced.
Thank you.
So I got some questions in the chat. I see it. Can you provide more information about the software you use to classify the chain aggregate data set? I actually have an extra slide for that. Believe it or not. Oh, okay. So this is actually one of the, let me minimize this real quick. So this is actually the software utilized for the classification process. So this is a MATLAB software specifically made for the FIPS classification. And so you can immediately see that there's two camera images, right? And this is actually why, you know, earlier in my talk, I state that having the two images is very beneficial for classifying the particles. Because if you look on the right, look at this main particle here, and then it looks like a compact aggregate, right? But then if you look at the other view, 120 degrees offset from that, you see that it is in fact a chain like aggregate. But going back to the software, it's really complex. And it's really beneficial when going through the classification of these particles, which by the way, I classified over 17,000 of these particles, which took me weeks. Don't want to talk about it. But you have a selection box over here, which you can select what type of habits that you see, as well as adding attributes, like whether it's an aggregate, a chain aggregate, is it rhyme, is there a pristine crystal in the frame of view, or is it sublimating? And then this is where the confidence level came into play, where you're able to rank the confidence based on the images shown. So yeah, if anyone would like to use this, and has FIPS data readily available, you just let me know, or some of the folks from KIT, College Rural Institute of Technology, which actually developed this software. So kudos to them, because this is top notch. You can ask me or them, and we can happily give that out to you guys, I guess, pending their permission. Emma and Martin. I hope that answered your question. Let's see here. Next one. Great talk. May have missed it, but are all flight legs similar to each other in altitude and level flight? Yes. Sorry for not mentioning that. I probably should have mentioned that. So each flight leg was an attempt to retrace the previous leg. And so all flight legs were at around 10 kilometers. Sampled at between minus 30 and minus 33 degrees Celsius. So yes, everything regarding the flight legs is constant. So sorry about not mentioning that, probably should have. So Haley has a question. Do you have any quantitative data about sublimation or thoughts on how to gather that data? So yes, I do. And that goes back to the FIPS classification software. So if you toggle the sublimation key right here, it adds that attribute to a text file for that given particle. So I have that number somewhere within my data, but I do not know the exact percentage of the overall image particles that were sublimated right off the back of my hand. I think that would have been a good extra slide to have. But yes, that we are able to quantify that data based on, and thanks to this FIPS classification software. So I can actually get back to you on that and give you actually a number of the overall sublimated particles, because I think that would be very beneficial when looking further down the front, a distance further from the storm core and looking at the sublimated particles. So now Taylor has a question. Love the talk. Do you have any more information regarding the National Lightning Detection Network? As I know, it was mentioned regarding the national. I'm not sure exactly what you mean by that, but I don't know. Taylor, are you here and you can speak?
Yes, I am here. I know you mentioned in your right in the beginning.
Yeah.
But I didn't know if you had any results from lightning.
Yeah. So here, let me go back to those slides here. I think it'll be easier if I end the show and then go to. So this slide here, so the smaller dots here on this plot is the National Lightning Detection Network, but it's just the CEG strokes. If I included the cloud to cloud or intercloud strokes, it was really messy. But the overall usage of the CEG strokes is to show everyone that these storms were, yes, electrically active and they contained lightning, because these chain aggregates need an electric field a relatively strong electric field to form, which is based off of the cloud chamber experiments. If you notice, if you have lightning associated with the convection being sampled, that can infer that the electric fields are, you know, strong enough within the main convective region and possibly the Sears anvil, solely based on the evidence of lightning, because you need strong electric fields, electrical difference between the lower negative charge region and the upper positive charge region to initiate lightning, as well as, you know, if the lower positive charge region is closest to the ground, you're going to see more cloud to ground lightning. So this basically indicates that our storm was relatively strong and was convective and produced lightning. So that's essentially what we used the NLDM for.
Awesome. Thanks.
Thank you.
Any more questions in the room here?
I have another question. Did storms that had more lightning strikes have more chain aggregates
I got your question. And I wish I can tell you right now. And that's the reason why we want to do an analysis on the other flight days for this campaign, because we only sampled one. So our Titan cell was the main cell that we, the Cirrus anvil produced from that Titan cell was the only region that we sampled from. So maybe it's possible if we look at the other flight days, we can correlate the amount of chain aggregates that we see to the amount of electrical activity that's happening in the storm. So that's actually an area of future research for sure. So that was a great question, John.
Very cool. I'm jealous of all the data you have. It's all very nice.
Oh, it's a lot of data. I had to cut a lot out just to make it to around the 45-minute mark. So if you guys have any more questions regarding the data, feel free to send me an email and I can fully elaborate on it. So.
Okay, so I think maybe we thank Christian once more.
Thank you guys. Thank you everyone.
Questions, thank you guys for coming. If the committee members could stay online, maybe we'll take a break here and then we'll talk to Christian some more.
And congrats, great presentation.
Thank you.
Very nice figures.
Thank you. Let's see.
Yeah, it's great talk.
Thanks, Jerry. Appreciate it. I'm going to refill my water bottle. I will be right back.
Likewise.
How's it going, Mike? How are you?
Hey, okay. Good job, Christian. Thanks.
Thank you. You enjoying retirement?
Yes, I am.
Can't wait. Can't wait to get there.
You can't wait to get there?
Come on. I can wait, but I just, you know, I've only been able to golf like 3 times this year. I just want to, my friends call me every single day during the weekday, like just ask to golf. I'm like,
So you've become a meteorologist so you can retire at the age of 30, huh?
Yeah, right. Yeah, yeah. Right. Make my million somehow, right?
Yeah, yeah. You're funny.
So, Mike, you got back on. You caught most of it?
I did. Yeah, some early connectivity issues. I don't know what Midco is doing with their internet, but it's fine for most of it, so I'm good.
Take internet right there.
Yeah, if you have issues, we can turn off my camera and stuff, but it seems to be good now.
Yeah. No, it was just completely dropped.
Oh, wow. Well, doesn't seem that this technology can work all the time. So,
so I totally forgot to record. Dave, were you recording that?
Yeah, I recorded. Oh, I better stop recording. Let me stop recording on my sessions. Stop recording. Stop recording. All right, stop. No, I have it recorded up here. So let's